From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Dr. Paul Offit gets a lot of hate mail. Offit is an expert of pediatric infectious disease, and for years now he's been drawing fire for saying that vaccines are safe. Offit is adamant. Vaccines, he says, may have their share of risks, but they do not cause autism, they don't cause autoimmune diseases, or for that matter, he says, they don't cause any other chronic conditions blamed on them by a growing movement of anti-vaccine crusaders. There really is no scientific evidence that makes a connection between vaccines and autism, for example, but more and more parents, desperate for answers or a cure, are withholding vaccines from their children. Paul Offit is joining us today to challenge these claims and to explore where they come from and their implications on public health. We invite you to join us after this news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Dr. Paul Offit understands why he gets a lot of hate mail, even death threats. He knows that throughout the internet, he's condemned for his unequivocal support for the science and effectiveness of vaccines. For years now, Offit has been outspoken about this and about challenging the growing chorus of voices who say vaccines cause autism. He understands the resistance, he says, because he knows that parents of children with autism are driven by this desperate desire for a cure, and he says they'll try anything. In his latest book, he mentions the treatments some of the parents have tried: enzymes, cod liver oil, activated charcoal, magnetic clays, high-temperature saunas. But he remains unmoved. He says vaccines may have their share of risks, but they do not cause autism. They don't cause autoimmune diseases or, for that matter, any of the other chronic conditions blamed on them. Today in the program, Dr. Paul Offit is joining us to make his case, talk about not just that, but why people are drawn to these ideas. His book is called Autism's False Prophets, Bad Science, Risky Medicine, and the Search for a Cure. And he's joining us today to talk about it. Dr. Paul Offit is the chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases and the director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He's written numerous books and medical articles, Vaccines and Children's Health. And Autism's False Prophets, we should say, is his most recent book, though he's working on another. And Dr. Offit is joining us by phone from his office today in Philadelphia. And Paul Offit, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
I guess it's important, if we're going to understand your role, that we understand the moments in your life that motivated you to do this work. And I wanted you to talk about the moments you mention in your book, a few of them that sort of led you here. First, this experience of rupturing your spleen, where and you met Milton Markowitz. That was an important moment for you.
Yes, he was that, you know, that image that many people have of their pediatrician when they're younger. He was a man who made house calls, and he had that big black bag that was full of this sort of sophisticated tubing and machinery and pills, and you just thought he was just sort of godlike in many ways. I mean, in that he would come to sort of help you. And I think for me, you know, because I was had ruptured my spleen and he had made the diagnosis which ultimately saved my life. I mean, he was just sort of permanently cemented as a heroic character, a doctor as hero.
Hmm. There's this other moment where you're treated for club feet, and the experience of being kind of isolated there in a hospital for weeks at a time, what influence did that have on the career you chose?
I think that more than anything else made me see children as underdogs. I mean, so here where I was in a polio ward, and there were about 20 children in that ward in a chronic care facility at a time when parents were only allowed to visit their children for 1 hour on the afternoon on Sunday, so the rest of the time you were there alone. And I saw these other children as sort of helpless and vulnerable and at some level tortured because they were suffering this disease, polio, and alone. And I guess my career choice as a pediatrician and ultimately a pediatric infectious disease specialist was, I think, largely compelled by that. I mean, I wanted to, at some level, go back and help those children.
Mm. And let's just mention one more moment that inspired you. This is a moment you say you'll never forget. I think it was 1977, the death of a little girl from a rotavirus infection, a moment that you say you'll never be able to forget and really absolutely sort of cemented in your mind. kind of an adamance about science, it seems.
Right. I remember I was an intern at Children's Hospital in Pittsburgh, and there was a mother who had come in who was, you know, very fiercely devoted to her child. She'd called her doctor when the child had fever and vomiting and diarrhea, was told by the doctor to give frequent sips of fluid, which she tried desperately to do, but the vomiting precluded that. And she, by the time she brought her child to the hospital, it was a little girl. You know, the child was severely dehydrated. We brought her back to the emergency department treatment room and tried to get an intravenous line in her, but couldn't because she was that dehydrated and had that little in the way of veins that were visible. We called the surgeon to come down. While he was coming down, we tried to actually just put a large bore kind of bone marrow needle into her bone just below her lower kneecap to try and get, you know, fluid in that way. And it was too late. You know, she died in front of us, and then we had to open the door and explain to the mother what had happened. And you know, it's just there's no moment worse than that. And yeah, I remember a few days later hearing that she had died of this virus, rotavirus, and remember reading in Journal of the American Medical Association an article called Fatal Rotavirus Gastroenteritis. And it was, you know, it's just that image was always in my mind when I went on this course at Children's in Philadelphia to try and make a rotavirus vaccine.
I want to get the disclosure part of this out of the way. Explain, if you would, your relationship to the pharmaceutical company Merck. I mean, you co-invented the vaccine Retrotrek tech for them. But, of course, opponents of your opponents say that this somehow disqualifies you from supporting vaccines. So I wanted you to just talk about that part so we can get that out of the way.
You know, I would argue it qualifies me. I mean, you know, I was funded by the National Institutes of Health from about 1981 when I came to Children's Hospital of Philadelphia as a fellow up until 2006. I actually didn't receive money from a pharmaceutical company. The science that I did on support of trying to make that vaccine was always funded by NIH, by public dollars. When we had something that we thought, when we had the strains in our laboratory that we thought could be a vaccine, we went to a pharmaceutical company. We went to actually several. We obviously weren't going to be able to do the research of development in our laboratory. The only pharmaceutical companies have that kind of expertise and resources. And so after looking at a number of companies, we ultimately chose Merck to try and make this a vaccine, and it took about 16 years to do that. So I think that sort of my experience in working with a virus to the point that we could make it into a vaccine and then ultimately doing the research of development, working with a pharmaceutical company to do that, I think that sort of gives me a unique perspective on just what vaccines are and how they're made and what their strengths and weaknesses are.
But what do you make of that as an element of criticism to your work, that pharmaceutical companies make millions and millions of dollars off of these things, that you yourself have benefited financially from these things?
I just think it's... I'm trying to figure out a nice way to say this. I just think it's sort of irrelevant. Certainly what motivated me to do the research and the rewards from the research were never financial. The reward was that I've been fortunate enough to live in a time where I could create with my coworkers, Fred Clark and Stan Plotkin, a technology that can save lives. And rotavirus kills 2,000 children a day in the developing world. And that's the reward. One could have never gone to a pharmaceutical company unless the technology was protected by a patent. But that was just never the motivating force. I think those who just don't like what I say choose to attack me personally because the data aren't on their side, so they just choose to attack the witness. But I'm not that affected by it. I because I know why I do what I do.
Yeah. Let me ask you, how do you react to the vehemence of the reaction to all of this? I mean, there've been lots of articles that talk about the fact that they're, you know, not just hate mail, but really nasty stuff, the death threats. And is there some part of you that understands the intensity of the feelings about all of this?
Sure. I think in this particular issue, which is, you know, vaccines and autism, I think parents who live with children who have, you know, severe autism, you know, face tremendous financial and emotional burdens. I think for those who believe it, and belief is the right word because, frankly, it has nothing to do with science. I mean, it's more like, you know, as one would have a religious belief, something that's immutable in the face of facts that are contrary. The feeling that this is true, that a pharmaceutical company has made a product, has profited off of a product which, you know, has caused their child to suffer, the emotion of that is certainly understandable. But I do, and although you, like many, point out the fact that I do get hate mail, and it's true. I get a lot of very supportive mail, and I was this. I think the perfect story for this. I had to testify in front of the state legislature in Connecticut, and when I was doing that, the woman came up afterwards, very angry at me, and was sort of screaming at me. And as I was being driven by a state senator to the train station, she said to me, "You know, when you know you're in the center of things when you meet the very best of people and the very worst of people." And I think that's true. But I certainly have been able to come in contact with people I would have never come in contact with, just people who are very much devoted to children's health, trying to do the right thing. I think I'm, on balance, very fortunate.
I guess the essential question is, what do we know about the nature of autism? Because the question here is whether or not there is any evidence at all that connects vaccinations to autism. You say there just isn't any.
Yeah, right. I mean, I think certainly it's understandable to raise the question. I mean, from the parent's standpoint, my child was fine. They got a vaccine. Then they weren't fine. Could the vaccine have done it? That's a scientific question and can be answered in a scientific venue. Initially, it was, you know, MMR vaccine caused autism. There have been 12 studies that have looked at children, hundreds of thousands of children who either got MMR vaccine or didn't, and the risk of autism is no different in those two groups. Same thing with thimerosal, this ethyl mercury-containing preservative in vaccines, which has essentially been out of any routine vaccine given to young infants since 2001, and the incidence of autism obviously hasn't gone down. If anything, it's increased. And so, I mean, those are scientific questions answered in a scientific venue. I think the part that's frustrating for me and should be frustrating, I think, to anyone in this country or the world is that when the science has addressed the question, we should be able to effectively communicate that science and help unburden these parents, at least as far as this particular issue is concerned. Mm-hmm. But I think that's been a struggle.
Yeah. So you hear this a lot from parents of children with autism that, first, that autism rates are going up. That's certainly the impression, and I wanted you to respond to this idea that there's now become this epidemic of autism, and there's got to be something that explains it. And a lot of people think there's got to be something in the drugs we're taking, in the food we're eating, that there are these. There's got to be an environmental trigger somewhere that explains it. How do you make sense of that?
Well, I think it's an unfortunate term, epidemic. I think what's happened in the mid-1990s is we broadened the definition of autism to include more subtle symptoms and signs associated with behavioral or communication or language issues. And so that dramatically increased the incidence of the disorder. Similarly, I think now with it's getting much more media attention, we're much more likely to recognize something we weren't recognizing before. But I think, I'm not an autism expert, I'm a vaccine and infectious disease expert, but right. I've heard from many autism experts who've said the same thing, which is if we took the current diagnostic criteria that we had and we went back in time 50 years, we'd find the same incidence of autism then that we do today.
Hmm. So to this question of environmental triggers, and you hear it a lot in not just in autism, but people are saying that the food that we're eating, the kinds of toxins and chemicals that are in the environment. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, that's certainly the current culture. I mean, we believe that we are being assailed by, you know, and that we're living in this sort of hellish world of toxins and chemicals. I think certainly there's a clear genetic component to autism. I mean, that's absolute. I mean, if you look at the incidence of autism in identical versus fraternal twins, there's information there. If you look at a recent study that was published in Nature by Hack and Arson and colleagues, looking at, you know, the genetics of autism and finding the specific defects associated with something called neural cell adhesion molecules, which is how one brain cell communicates with another, that sort of all drives things, frankly, into the womb in terms of where these critical events are happening. So I'm comforted by the science, which I think is all adding up. But I think if you use the term environment as anything other than genetic, yes, I do think there are environmental influences. I mean, certainly women who took thalidomide, women who took an anti-seizure medicine called valproic acid, women who were infected inadvertently with rubella virus in their first or second trimester, those babies then had an increased incidence of autism. So I think there are things that can happen from the environment that can influence the development of autism, but I don't think any of them, frankly, are likely to occur postnatally.
Mm. Dr. Offit, help us understand, because you get at this in your book, the movement that opposes vaccinations. There's a good piece in the article Wired from the journalist Amy Wallace that says that this movement crosses party lines and religious lines, class lines. Is that true? And do you think you understand who these people are? I guess that are opposed to vaccination.
Yeah, I think it's the culture. I think a number of things have come to confluence at the same time. First, I think for the most part we're motivated by our own fears, compelled by our fears, and you for the most part vaccines are a victim of their own success. You don't see vaccine preventable diseases today much anymore. So it's you're not as compelled to vaccinate. Certainly for my parents, or even for me and my wife, you know, we saw these diseases growing up, so vaccines are an easy sell. But for young parents today, it's not only that they don't see these diseases, they didn't even grow up with these diseases. So for them, vaccination becomes a matter of faith. And faith in whom? In pharmaceutical companies, in the federal government, in the healthcare establishment. And I think, you know, we live in a much more cynical time. I think that kind of faith, anyway, isn't around so much anymore.
Yeah. It's interesting. Wallace points out in her article that unlike the debates over, creationism and global warming, that Democrats are just as likely as Republicans to, I think she puts it this way, fuel this kind of anxiety. I mean, she talks about Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and John Kerry, Christopher Dodd, senator from Connecticut. Is that surprising to you?
Yes, disappointingly so. As a Democrat, I think that President Obama, says exactly what it is that you want to hear. I quote: "I want to make science-based decisions." It's clearly a very different stance from our last president. And so, when Democrats like Dodd or others, Kerry, stand up for anecdotes, stand up, frankly, against the science. It's upsetting. And I think part of it, I'd like to believe this isn't true, but I think part of it is the Democrats certainly are very much proponents of the Trial Lawyers Association. And, you know, there are some, you know, I think that when you blame pharmaceutical company products for things, there's money to be had.
Dr. Paul Offit is with us. He is with the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. His most recent book is called Autism's False Prophets, Bad Science, Risky Medicine, and the Search for a Cure. We're going to take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are exploring this question of whether vaccines somehow cause autism. There really is no scientific evidence that makes the connection. But for some reason, there's a growing movement that blames vaccines for autism and a host of neurological conditions. More and more parents are responding by withholding vaccines from their children. Our guest today is Dr. Paul Offit, who challenges these claims. In fact, he says those who make them, he calls them, are modern-day false prophets who are using risky medicine and bad science to find a cure or a reason for autism. Let's go to the phones. Christine is joining us in Cottonwood Heights, Utah. Christine, welcome.
Hi. Thanks so much for doing the show.
Sure.
I, for the last 2 years, have worked with children on the autism spectrum, doing mostly like early intervention therapies. I've worked with like 4 dozen kids, so I've been able to talk to lots of parents, and I'm totally a believer that it's not vaccines that are causing autism. I think that there's a genetic basis and possibly like an environmental trigger that's not vaccines. But I've seen parents do all kinds of things that are very unsafe with their kids. I've worked with families who've spent upwards of like $150,000 a year to do chelation with their children, which can be very dangerous, and just giving them supplements that don't work and things. But and just reading the science, it makes no sense to me that you would correlate vaccines with this. But one thing I have not been able to account for is the amount of parents who've told me the exact same story about how their children have regressed. And it's always, like, the same factors. It's my kid was fine. We went and got, it's when they get, like, all their vaccines at once. They're not doing it, one every couple of months or whatever. It's like, they had all of them at once. They had a fever. They went to sleep, and they woke up and were banging their head into the tiles. They're flicking objects. They, lost all their language and stuff. And I've just never been able to account for how I've been hearing that same story from all these parents when, you know, the science isn't there, but yet here are these stories that are identical from parents who are very educated and have read lots of books on the subject and from parents who just had their kid diagnosed and haven't read anything yet. So I guess I wanted to hear the author's response to that and maybe where the story's originating from.
Yeah, Dr. Offit, what do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think anecdote is a powerful thing. It's but the vaccines could in any way sort of alter or overwhelm or perturb the immune system. It just doesn't jive with the number of challenges in vaccines. I mean, if you look, for example, at the 14 vaccines today and add up the number of immunological components in that vaccine, and by immunological component, I mean bacterial protein or viral protein or bacterial polysaccharide, it's about 150, just to give you a sense of what's in those vials. If you look at the one vaccine that we got 100 years ago, the smallpox vaccine, which is a pox virus, the largest of the mammalian viruses, that vaccine alone had far more immunological components, so really about 200, than all the 14 vaccines we get today. I mean, you can argue, I think, reasonably that a simple infection with a common cold virus like rhinovirus is a far more of an immunological challenge than vaccines are. So, you know, when you're in the womb, you're in a sterile environment. When you enter the birth canal in the world, you're not. Very quickly, you have living on the surface of your body literally trillions of bacteria to which you make an immune response every day. You know, you make grams of antibodies like immunoglobulin G and immunoglobulin A. And so vaccines are a pretty trivial challenge to your immune system. It doesn't make biological sense. And I think, although anecdotes are powerful, I think this has been a misleading one.
Mm. Christine, glad you called.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. One of the cautionary tales you tell in your book is the 1916 outbreak of polio and how people reacted to that, who they blamed, what they did about that. What are the lessons we can take from that experience?
I think the lessons are never learned, which are that if you look over the last few hundred years in medicine, when there is a disease or a disorder for which you don't have a clear cause and for which there isn't a clear cure, there is always that aspect of my profession that is perfectly willing to step up and say, sure, the medical establishment doesn't know, but I know, and I have a treatment for you because I care. Mm-hmm. And it's a level of charlatanism and quackery that we've tolerated for several hundred years. It becomes an industry, and that's been true here. I think in 1916, no one knew what caused polio. Actually, they should have, because actually a few years earlier, polio had been identified as a virus, but that hadn't seeped through, I think, to most of the residents of New York City. And so they blamed everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, they blamed, you know, organ grinders, monkeys, you know, and poison vapors from Europe. I mean, whatever one could imagine. And there were those who proffered cures that not only didn't work, but often made you worse. And they were very profitable. Mm-hmm. And that's no different today. I mean, you know, fast forward 100 years, and still we're offering the same sort of things. I mean, it's more sophisticated, it's more expensive, it sounds better because it's couched more in medical jargon. But the fact is, it's still quackery, and it's still not science-based, and it still sort of fills in the gaps for what clearly is a lack of knowledge. The frustrating thing for me is there actually is a lot of very good autism research that has taught us much here, and I just don't think we've been able to get that kind of research out to the public to reassure them.
I guess the point is that people then with polio, now with autism and other diseases, they feel isolated, they feel afraid, they feel kind of desperate. And in some ways, science isn't, because there's a lot of nuance, right, and a lot of uncertainty, that it doesn't seem as comforting as something that says, take this, rub this oil on, and it will work.
Absolutely right, Doug. And I think the right now, if you look at what's known about autism, one knows, I think, a lot about the areas of the brain that are involved, the proteins on the surface of brain cells that are involved, when those things start to happen, but it hasn't yet resulted in a clear cure. And which is to say, take this and you'll feel better. And so, as the previous caller Christine said, you know, there are people who she sees giving chelation therapy, which is a kind of therapy that binds to heavy metals like mercury or lead to rid them from your body to make you better. Well, that's certainly nonsensical. It doesn't make a bit of sense that it would work for many reasons. It doesn't work. But you know, it's the sort of the power of positive thinking by proxy, right? I'm going to do this for my child, and they're going to feel better. And probably there's no better example of that, actually, than secretin. This was all the rage in the 1990s. This is a bovine, a hormone that's made by bovine intestinal cells, cow intestinal cells, to help the pancreas secrete its juices. And there was a woman in Maryland who believed, a mom of a child with autism, who believed that that had made her child better. And it became all the rage. People traveled hundreds of miles, spent thousands of dollars to get this hormone injected into their bloodstream, into the child's bloodstream, until it was tested. And when it was tested, it was the first of really 15 studies that looked at this, children either got this injected into their bloodstream or they got salt water injected into their bloodstream. Their parents didn't know which one they got, the doctors didn't know which one they got, and the evaluators didn't know which one they got. And what was shown was that there was no difference between the two groups. But interestingly, in both groups, the child was perceived as having done better, even those that just got the salt water, showing that these parents had a desperate desire to appreciate their child as being better when they had spent hundreds of dollars on a therapy to make them better. And eventually the secretin story died down, and now nobody uses secretin anymore, and now we're just on to the next wave of fanciful therapies.
Let's go back to the phones. Norm is with us in Gothenburg, Nebraska. Norm, hi.
Hello, gentlemen. Doctor, I've heard much about the evils of thimerosal. And my question is, before there was thimerosal, what did science use as a preservative in vaccines? And could you give us anything positive about that agent?
Can we explain that thimerosal is a mercury preservative used in what was used in vaccines? Dr. Offit?
Well, and still is used in some multi-dose preparations of the influenza vaccine. That's the only vaccine that still contains preservative levels of thimerosal. Thimerosal was, Norm, your question was what was used before that? Nothing. That was the problem, which is, so when you had multi-dose vials, say, made with vaccines in the early 1900s, vials that would contain, say, as many as 10 doses of vaccine, you know, the nurse or the doctor would violate that rubber stopper with the needle and pull out one or two or five or eight doses and then put the vial back in the refrigerator. Well, often the vial would become inadvertently contaminated with bacteria or fungi, which would then be injected into the child who got the ninth or tenth dose. And there are plenty of reports in the medical literature of children with, you know, with abscesses or systemic infection or even fatal infections caused by bacteria like staph and strep. Until an ethyl mercury preservative was added to vaccines, which really started in around the 1930s, and that pretty much eliminated the problem. Really, any time you have a multi-dose vial, you have to have some sort of preservative in there, whether it's thimerosal or 2-phenoxyethanol. It has to be something. I mean, the good news is that it's ethyl mercury. It's not environmental mercury, which is methylmercury. It's excreted from the body 10 times more quickly. If you look at the amount of mercury that children are typically exposed to, because we all live on the planet Earth, where mercury is part of every glass of water we drink, or every fish we eat, the amount of mercury that's contained in vaccines is really less than children get if they're breastfed or bottle fed in the first 6 months of life. So it never made sense it would have been a problem. It isn't a problem. But you're right. I mean, mercury's never going to sound good. High levels of mercury are toxic to the nervous system. It's not like there's, you know, the National Association for the Appreciation of Heavy Metals coming in defense of mercury. But the fact of the matter is, the dose always makes the poison. And we all have small amounts of heavy metals like cadmium or thallium or beryllium or even arsenic in our body that are not toxic because they're, you know, at very low levels. There's no avoiding low levels of things that are potentially toxic. The point is to keep them at low levels. And certainly the quantity of thimerosal contained in vaccines was never harmful. And it's largely out of vaccines. And frankly, it's out of all, you know, routine vaccines given to young babies now anyway.
Well, officials, they made this statement, which you found troubling, that current levels of thimerosal will not hurt children, but reducing those levels will make safe vaccines even safer. You're opposed to that idea. Why remove it if it's not a problem? That seemed, in your mind, to just make it worse.
Well, it was internally contradictory. Yeah. I mean, that's exactly what the American Academy of Pediatrics said in 1999 when they sort of, I think in what was a very frightening manner, removed thimerosal from vaccines. They said all the evidence to date is that thimerosal at the level contained in vaccines isn't harmful, but to make safe vaccines even safer, we're going to do this. Well, if it's not harmful, then how does taking it out make it safe? Safer, yeah. Doesn't it? It just makes it perceived to be safer, which is a very different thing. And I think thimerosal certainly has been branded with a scarlet letter from which it will never escape. And you're seeing it now with the novel H1N1 vaccine, which, you know, some multi-dose vials of which obviously contain thimerosal. And it's, you know, people are more scared of that vaccine, which contains levels of mercury that are probably less than they're being exposed to if they eat a can of tuna fish, than they are of a virus, which clearly is sweeping across the country and causing a lot of hospitalization and death, which tells us, me at least, of our inability to determine where the real risks lay.
Let's go back to the phones. Mark is joining us in Park City. Mark, welcome.
Hi, good morning, Doug.
Good morning.
Hey, I have a question, well, more like a comment and a question. I have a daughter with autism, and she is a classic case of, you know, healthy child up until she took the MMR vaccine when she was around a year old. And then after that, she went into a severe fever, and, you know, she had to be hospitalized because she went into a seizure. And then after that, we started noticing her, you know, regression and learning skills and things like that. And soon after, you know, she was diagnosed with autism. And back then, she's 12 years old. It wasn't so, you know, commonly known or as, you know, how it is right now. So my thing is I don't discount the vaccines completely as a possible cause or catalyst. It seems to me that the doctor and many in the scientific community take the stance that just because we haven't been able to find a clear correlation between the vaccines and autism, that's just because that doesn't exist, that doesn't justify the fact that these people, you know, the scientists take the stance that it is completely out of the question. In other words, I feel that there could be something we just haven't found in the science, some sort of catalyst within the vaccine that can trigger, you know, this autism.
Mark, let me add to that, Dr. Offit, before you respond, an email which has a similar kind of comment. This is from Mariana, who writes, isn't it too soon to tell? Wouldn't we need to let many years or a few generations even pass before we can say with any certainty that there is absolutely no correlation between increased vaccinations and any of these chronic issues? What do you say, Dr. Offit?
Well, I would say it certainly, Mark, it's perfectly reasonable to raise the question. I mean, your child was fine. They got an MMR vaccine and they weren't fine. Is it the MMR vaccine that could have done it? The good news is one can answer that question. I mean, there have been now 12 very large studies done on several different continents by many different groups of investigators to answer it, and can't find even a shred of evidence that MMR is at fault. And I think even more importantly are now the scientific data that are coming out, I think, in leaps and bounds, looking at autism to try and answer the question, really, when do you become autistic? And I think what these genetic studies have shown, and what you know, these sort of more functional studies done by people like Ami Klin at the Yale Child Study Center, where he can do, has a essentially a test he can do where he can determine whether you're autistic in the first couple weeks of life. I think that when you're autistic at 5, you're autistic at 2, you're autistic at 1, you're autistic when you're born. And although those symptoms may not become evident until a child is older, the fact of the matter is it was there very early on. So I think all of that adds up to the fact that vaccines aren't it. And I think we just keep focusing on what I think is a dead-end, fruitless hypothesis to the advantage of no one.
Mark, we're glad you called. Thanks very much. Dr. Paul Offit is with us, author of the book Autism's False Prophets, Bad Science, Risky Medicine, and the Search for a Cure. We need to take another brief break. We'll be back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We're back with Dr. Paul Offit. He's author of the book Autism's False Prophets, Bad Science, Risky Medicine, and the Search for a Cure. Dr. Offit is the chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases and the director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and he's joining us from his office there. Here's an email from Jeff, who writes, I'm the parent of a child who was recently diagnosed with autism, and I am also a scientist. I'm not sure how I feel about a cure for autism. I know from my experience with my son and others with autism that these people are unique. He writes, I feel there needs to be a balance between helping an individual learn to live in a non-autistic world and yet allowing the child the opportunity to retain their individualism. It seems to me our society wants to make a judgment on who's acceptable and who is not. Dr. Offit, what do you think about that idea, just as opposed to sort of pushing for some kind of cure, accepting the fact that these children and these people have autism?
I completely agree. And there's a there are a number of groups that share the email writer's belief as well, which is that one of which is called perfectly neurodiversity.com, which is that we have a range of behaviors. Autism represents part of that range, and that it is as acceptable as anything else. And I think that's true. I mean, last night I was in an event in D.C. Hosted by Bill and Melinda Gates, and I actually got to talk to Mr. Gates at the end of it. And you know, he's an interesting guy. He certainly, his history as a young child was one of sort of hand flapping, of not being able to easily emote or communicate, comfortably. And you know, when I met him, he's just obviously a brilliant man who's it's like sort of feeding data in when you talk to him, and you sort of hear the analysis of the data coming out. But he's not a very emotional guy. He doesn't really, you know, look at your eyes very much. He doesn't emote very much. And I suspect he's, you know, if we went back in time and evaluated him, we would put him on the spectrum, maybe as Asperger's syndrome, but something on the spectrum, you know, and he's doing fine. I think he's certainly seems to be functional. But, you know, and so I think there is that range of behavior, and arguably, and many people have argued, you know, certainly on the mild end, why really try and work with somebody to change something that is inherently them and not necessarily a bad thing? I think that makes sense.
Let's go back to the phones. Mason has been waiting in Salt Lake. Mason, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
No problem. Thanks, Doug.
Sure.
Doctor, first of all, I just want to make the comment. I appreciate you working on the rotavirus vaccine. My son was diagnosed with rotavirus when I was in Iraq, and he was in the ICU for about 4 or 5 days. Probably could have killed him. And since then, I had never heard of it before then, and since then, I have a daughter that's younger than him that hasn't vaccinated. I'm a huge believer in vaccines, and the last thing that I worry about with my kids is becoming autistic because they get a vaccine. I think it's irresponsible for parents not to get their children vaccinated, if for no other reason than the fact that I don't want my children exposed to something that's easily preventable.
Hmm. Which raises the question, Dr. Offit, about what are the implications for this movement of this anti-vaccine movement? Are vaccination rates declining?
If you look at it, sort of stand back and look at the nation in general, the data are very reassuring. But there are certainly pockets of people where there are communities that are relatively under-vaccinated. And it's not a theoretical problem anymore. I mean, we certainly saw a measles epidemic in 2008 that was larger than anything we've seen in more than a decade. We've seen outbreaks of pertussis or whooping cough in communities that where the outbreak looks like it looked in the pre-vaccine era, meaning primarily affecting the 5 to 9-year-old, which is unusual. And, you know, we're now having cases of bacterial meningitis caused by a bacteria that's in vaccines, so-called Haemophilus influenza type B, that has killed children in the Philadelphia area and one in Minnesota, in parents who are choosing not to vaccinate their children, all because they're scared that vaccines are hurting them, and part of that is a fear of autism. It's awful. And I think we're reaching a tipping point, actually, because also one has to consider that when you choose not to get a vaccine, you're not only making a choice for yourself, you're making a choice for the child sitting next to you. That was certainly the story with last year's measles epidemic, especially in San Diego, where children just waiting in a pediatrician's waiting room with someone who ultimately was diagnosed with measles had been too young to get vaccinated. Three of them were hospitalized, three of them were made ill, one of whom was severely ill and was hospitalized. So, and there are hundreds of thousands of people in this country who can't be vaccinated because they're immunosuppressed for their, for their transplants, or they're getting chemotherapy for their cancer, or steroids for their asthma. They depend on those around them to be vaccinated. They sort of depend on that social contract, which clearly is being broken.
Mm. So these vaccines should be mandatory. You're opposed to this idea of states letting people opt out of vaccines.
Well, I think that for now, I'm not sure what the effect of mandating vaccines would be. I mean, certainly in hospitals now, you're starting to see influenza vaccine be mandated. That I think, frankly, is a good idea, because there it's not just your social responsibility. I think it's your professional responsibility not to give influenza to someone who's sick in the hospital. So that, I think, is the easiest thing. But you know, you can argue that sort of opting out of vaccines, either for religious reasons or philosophical reasons, is a necessary pop-off valve in a country that's asking their citizens to get, you know, 14 different vaccines in the first few years of life, which can be as many as 26 inoculations and 5 shots. Mm-hmm. But we may get to a point where we have tipped over, and where we are asking ourselves, is it your right, is it your inalienable right to catch and transmit a potentially fatal infection? I don't quite think we're there yet, but, you know, we very well may be getting there.
Hmm. Let's go back to the phones. Jennifer is joining us in Ashland, Oregon. Jennifer, welcome.
My question relates to the statement the doctor made about the dosage equals the poison. And I was wondering if you could expand on that. I've been doing a lot of research on toxicity, and from what I understand, the latest research shows that that's not necessarily true, that small doses sneak into the body and can actually be more harmful and disruptive to the endocrine system than a large dose, which the body knows, like recognizes as poison and thus gets rid of. So my concern with the vaccines is that these toxins are not actually being recognized as being toxic and thus staying in the body and causing harm.
Hmm.
Is there any truth to that?
Dr. Offit.
Yeah, no, in short. But I mean, usually if you look through sort of the toxicology literature or textbooks, you can divide toxins into sort of two categories. There are those, and you know, heavy metals would be an example of it, where increasingly higher doses are associated with increasingly higher toxicity. It's higher, I mean, because the heavy metal enters the cell and damages the cell. And even for light metals like aluminum, that is also true. More is worse. Then there are toxins that are so-called mutagenic toxins, where they will enter a cell and cause the cell to be, you know, to become cancerous, for example. I mean, formaldehyde, at least in laboratory cells, can do that. And there you sort of reach just a level where that event occurs, and, you know, more doesn't necessarily make it worse. And so there it's not a clear what is called by toxicologists a dose response curve. But I think, you know, I don't think you have to invent new rules for biology to sort of explain these things. I think the dose makes the poison. Similarly, you can drink gallons of water at once and lower your serum sodium to the point that you will have a seizure and could in fact die. And that's happened to a Chico State student who was being hazed. It happened to a woman in I think in California also, who, you know, I think it was the promotion was, you know, hold your wee for wee, who also died of a seizure associated with drinking too much water, which doesn't mean water is toxic. I think it just means that if you drink a lot of it at once, you can hurt yourself. So I think that the fact that the statement the dose makes the poison, which was first made by a chemist in the 16th century, still holds true today. So, and Jennifer, you live in Ashland, Oregon. Get out of there, Jennifer. I mean, that's probably one of the lowest immunization rate areas in the United States.
Hmm. Jennifer, glad you called. Thanks very much. Back to the phones. Jim, who's with us in Salt Lake City. Jim, hi.
Hello. I'd like to address the apparent epidemic aspect of it. The fact that today I think Asperger's is as much and autistic spectrum is more recognized than it was in the past. Pardon me, I've got a very severe laryngitis. I probably have the flu. But I'm 68 years old, a retired chemistry professor, fairly successful as a researcher and teacher. And recently, one of my grandsons was diagnosed with Asperger's. And going over the questionnaire for the parents, four pages of stuff, I basically, in retrospect for myself, I flunked that. And it explained a great deal in my life. But back in 60 years ago, I was just a weird little kid that was a geek, didn't have a lot of friends, and couldn't look people in the eye.
Dr. Offit, that story resonates, I guess, for you.
Yes, very much so. I mean, I think, you know, I can certainly think back to my elementary school class, and I can think of certainly one and possibly two children who clearly would have fallen on the spectrum. And that's what Jim said is exactly right. You know, we would think that they were a little odd or a little nerdy or geeky or whatever the word was that was used, but autism spectrum disorder wasn't something that was ever said then. And similarly on the other side, on the more extreme side, I mean, people who have severe autism were just called mentally retarded and often institutionalized. So it's, I think we sort of broaden things at both ends of the spectrum. You almost never hear the term mentally retarded anymore.
Mm. Jim, glad you called. Thanks a lot. You know, it's interesting, Dr. Offit, the Internet. I wonder what kind of a factor that is playing. Because on one hand, it's great to be able to access all of this information. But what effect is that having on this argument, on this debate?
Well, tremendous effect. Yeah. I think that the Internet is a source of wonderful and awful information. And if you have a particular unusual theory, you're going to be able to find, you know, several hundred people on the Internet who have that unusual theory. And you can get together and try and become a vocal force both in the media and in Congress. I think it's a rapid way of being able to get, you know, groups that are bound together by, you know, theories that frankly have no base in science to, you know, to get together and be a force. I think it's good news and bad news. I think on the one hand we have information at our fingertips that could be enormously helpful. On the other hand, you know, it can be very much harmful the way it's handled.
And what about our role in the media? What effect are we having? It seems, if we're not careful, we could be causing some problems there.
Yeah, I think that understates it. I mean, I would have argued that a few years ago, and I think the media's actually gotten better, certainly on the vaccine autism story, but, you know, the journalistic mantra is balance, you know, that you tell two sides of a story even when only one side is supported by the science. I think controversy sells. It's often the story is told as a he said, she said, even when only when fair balance would be to have 1,000 people, scientists on one side and one on the other. So I think it is certainly a disproportionate explanation often for what the real facts are. And I think the media did, certainly initially in this story, did much to confuse the public. I think between the omnibus autism proceeding, which was that legal proceeding that which was adjudicated last February, and other things, I just think that the media has just gotten much more responsible in this. It's actually been very encouraging.
I'm interested. I know you read somewhere that you're writing a book about the anti-vaccine movement, and I'm intrigued about what you're learning about that, about this inclination to you know, resist the experts and resist these kinds of things. Do you get a sense of what's at the heart of all of that?
Yes, I think it. Well, I mean, I'll tell you what my guess is. I think there's this sort of postmodernist thinking, which is that all attitudes and ideas and beliefs are of equal value, that expertise doesn't really matter, that experience doesn't really matter, that you can simply Google the term vaccines and you are just as much of an expert as anybody else, independent of what their training is or their experience is, which is odd to me. I mean, I always find it, my wife's in private practice pediatrics, and, you know, she's always surprised when people come in and after spending some time on the internet believe that they know absolutely more than she does, and it's frustrating. I mean, just I'll give you a personal experience. I mean, I recently had knee pain, and I sort of, you know, Googled, you know, sort of knee pain, trying to figure out what at my age group would be likely to cause that. And so when I went to the orthopedist, I felt that I could at least ask intelligent questions, but never for a moment would I have believed that I would know more than he would about, you know, the causes of knee pain or you know, how he should do the surgery. But, you know, I think that these days it's there's just a sense that, and maybe it's just a matter of controlling, you know, that you then have more control if you can sort of dictate how things can be done on for something that you don't really understand that well. Mm. But I think it's all part of it.
Let's go back to the phones. Carolyn is with us in Salt Lake City. Carolyn, hi.
Hi. I wanted to thank you for the show, and I wanted to thank Dr. Offit. My son, Michael, is 20, and he has autism, and it has always, one of the reasons why I haven't been more involved with the autism community is that I get the impression that so many people want it to be different, and I understand that. I mean, finding out that there was something, you know, wrong with him was horrible for me, and it has been harder to raise him than raising another child. But, you know, I celebrate who he is. He is a wonderful person, and he's got this great sense of humor. He's not Asperger's. He truly has autism. But, you know, he's learned some things. I look forward to a time when he may have a job. And I understand why there's all this, you know, I want to find out what happened to my kid and medicine should fix it and everything. But you know what? It's who he is. It's as much him as his beautiful brown hair and his beautiful brown eyes and his cute little sense of humor. I mean, I love my son, and I decided to spend time in helping him adapt to a society that didn't necessarily understand him rather than wanting to blame somebody, because that doesn't solve the problem for me.
Hmm. You know, Carolyn, it's your story I've heard from many mothers, interestingly, and in many contexts, one of which is the anger that, for example, when thimerosal was considered to be, you know, the cause, that you know, people would parade their children in front of the Capitol, you know, with signs that would say "damaged by mercury," because what those mothers hated was the notion that they would parade a child around with a T-shirt that said "damaged" on it, that they expressed just the same feeling you did, which is that you know, they appreciated their child, they want others to appreciate their child, and to not see them as, you know, as harmed because, you know, they were just trying to appreciate them for what they were. And it's a story that the media doesn't want to tell. Because I often refer, because I get a lot of media calls, you know, to parents like you who want to state that point of view, and also to parents whose children have autism that don't think vaccines are a cause at all. And it's just not the story the media wants to tell. Whenever they have a parent of a child with autism, it's always, you know, I'm angry because this happened to my child and I think that vaccines did it. And it's unfair, because I really do think you're part of a majority that doesn't get heard from. I do think that the parents one hears from, you know, that are angry that vaccines were the cause, represent actually a minority of autism parents from whom I've been incredibly impressed. If I had to do the book all over again, the book that I've written on this subject, I would have been much fairer to parents, because I didn't. It was only till after I wrote the book that I realized that there was this silent majority out there that I had never tapped into. And there's a paperback version of this book that's coming out in a few months. And in my prologue to the new edition, it's that apologia that I have, because I think that's the one thing I regret in the book.
About 30 seconds left. Let me ask you this finally. You've said that scientists have to be held accountable for staying silent. Are other scientists joining you?
A little bit, yes. Yes, I would say other scientists are joining me. It's not a natural act. I think it's hard to explain science in a public forum. It, certainly you're not trained to do it. It's hard to take complex issues and make them bite-sized. But yes, I think they are. I think we realize how much is at stake now that we're seeing children die of vaccine-preventable diseases.
Dr. Paul Offit, he's the author of the book Autism's False Prophets, Bad Science, Risky Medicine, and the Search for a Cure. And as he said, it's coming out soon in paperback. Joined us from his office in Philadelphia. Dr. Offit, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. For links to resources mentioned in today's program or to continue the conversation on our online discussion board, you can visit our website at KUER.org. KUER's operations director is Michael Havey. Our engineer is Lewis Downey. Our station manager is John Green. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson. The program is produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.